Bonjour et bienvenue à Tour de table. Je m'appelle Frédéric Mérand et je suis professeur de sciences politiques à l'Université de Montréal. Avec ma collègue Jennifer Welch, professeure de sciences politiques à l'Université McGill de l'autre côté du Mont-Royal, nous animons ce balado bilingue consacré aux affaires internationales d'un point de vue montréalais, québécois, saskatchewanais et canadien. Bonjour Jennifer.
Allô.
Allô. Alors aujourd'hui, contrairement à notre habitude, nous enregistrons un épisode spécial sans invité, juste Jennifer et moi. C'est moi qui vais interroger Jennifer, qui revient tout juste d'un séjour en Ukraine. J'ai pensé que son regard aiguisé de politologue sur le terrain pouvait nous aider à comprendre des aspects souvent négligés de cette guerre qui va bientôt entrer dans sa troisième année. Alors, je présente un peu Jennifer parce que, outre ses activités scientifiques, elle a une longue expérience de collaboration avec l'Organisation des Nations Unies, avec l'ONU. Et depuis 2 ans, Jennifer, tu es membre d'un groupe d'experts sur les personnes déplacées à l'intérieur de leur propre pays, c'est-à-dire ce qu'on pourrait appeler des réfugiés internes ou en anglais « internally displaced people ». Alors, ton groupe d'experts est associé au Haut Commissariat pour les réfugiés des Nations Unies, le HCR, mais vous travaillez aussi avec la rapporteuse spéciale sur les droits humains des personnes déplacées, Paola Gaviria Betancourt, qui t'a invité, si je comprends bien, à l'accompagner avec le groupe en Ukraine pendant la première semaine de novembre.
Oui, tout à fait. It was a fantastic experience to accompany her.
Alors, commençons par mettre la table. Peux-tu nous brosser un tableau général de la situation des personnes déplacées à l'intérieur de l'Ukraine aujourd'hui?
Absolument. And I'd say, Frédéric, it's a really good occasion to stop and reflect on the trip, but also on the topic of internally displaced peoples or IDPs. Because this population is often neglected. When we think about conflicts or humanitarian crises, we have a tendency to concentrate on those displaced who cross a frontier and become refugees. But if you think of today's numbers of the 100 million roughly people in the world who have been forcibly displaced, 62.5 of those are displaced inside their country. They have not crossed a border. And they're often in very precarious situations where their fundamental needs aren't being satisfied. And in lots of those contexts with IDPs, the government can in fact be a main part of the problem, because either the government itself has sought to displace a population it views as constituting a threat, or it doesn't take responsibility for the protection of populations that have been displaced. And of course, in Ukraine, it's très différent. So according to UN data, just over 13 million Ukrainians have been forced to flee in search of safety due to Russia's invasion. And as of October 2023, 5.8 million of these are refugees in Europe. And about 390,000 are refugees in other countries. The remainder, 4.9 million, are internally displaced. And I should say that a portion of those are also those displaced after the 2014 annexation of Crimea. Many of these displaced people are elderly, over 1 million, and 1 million are children under 18. 200,000 of them roughly have disabilities, and as I came to see in Ukraine, those with disabilities are particularly vulnerable in these contexts. So our mission to Ukraine was designed really to understand, support, and enhance the Ukrainian government's own capacities to protect and provide solutions for its displaced population. And so this involved sustained discussion with the Ombudsperson for Ukraine, so effectively their National Human Rights Commission, politicians, many of whom are displaced themselves, the Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament, government ministers and civil servants, and of course, civil society. And we also engaged in discussion with the large UN country team in Ukraine and representatives from countries' missions there. And there's a number of pieces of legislation and policy frameworks that have been put in place to address the challenge of IDPs. So, for example, In April of 2023, the government adopted a state strategy on internal displacement, including priorities related to the safe evacuation of displaced persons, help with integration, employment, the provision of basic needs, but also the management of collective sites where a portion of IDPs are living today. So about 120,000 are living in temporary collective sites across the country. So that was the nature of the mission.
Alors, on va revenir plus tard sur la réalité des personnes déplacées à l'interne et puis aussi sur d'autres aspects de l'Ukraine aujourd'hui. Et j'aimerais quand même pour que tous nos auditeurs et toutes nos auditrices comprennent bien le contexte dans lequel on peut se rendre aujourd'hui en Ukraine, que tu nous parles un peu de la façon dont tu t'y es rendu, que tu partages tes impressions du pays. On sait par exemple qu'il est impossible aujourd'hui de prendre un vol commercial vers l'Ukraine, il faut prendre le train. Donc, peux-tu nous parler un peu des conditions de ton séjour en Ukraine?
Oui, yes, of course. And you're right. So it isn't possible to fly into Ukraine. What we did, along with many others who travel there, we flew into a small airport in eastern Poland, where our UNHCR hosts picked us up and took us across the border to Lviv, where we had some meetings, but then took a train to Kiev. So the train system, which is fantastic. In fact, I took trains in Ukraine many, many years ago, actually when it was still part of the Soviet Union. And that's how we got around. And I would say in terms of impressions, there, at least in the period that I was there, in the last part of October and early November, it was quite warm. And many people in Ukraine talked about how there had been a lull in some of the air raids and aerial attacks. It was a good period in Ukraine where a lot of life had seemed to gotten back to normal. The cities were very vibrant in the evenings. You definitely feel that the demographics have changed in terms of the need for men of fighting age to be in the eastern part of the country. And one of the things, of course, I was very struck by in our meetings as well is the degree to which women have stepped up into incredibly important roles in the government, but also in civil society as a result of that. But I'd say just in terms of personal safety, because we didn't leave Ukraine or Lviv, we were nowhere near the Eastern Front, we felt quite safe. You live with the possibility of air raid sirens during the night, which we experienced, and the cities are very well equipped with shelters that you go down into when that occurs, and it's very high tech. You have an app that tells you when and where to go, with levels, different levels of severity of the threat. And there's a sense that this has become part of daily life.
Donc, une forme de distance, finalement, entre la vie quotidienne à Kiev, par exemple, et la ligne de front où on s'imagine que c'est une situation véritablement de guerre et d'une extrême violence qu'on ne sent pas nécessairement malgré les attaques ou les couvre-feux à Kiev.
Yes, but I think I would say two things about the way that one experiences this. I mean, certainly when you enter Kiev train station, in our case, we were going west, but one evening when we were leaving, we saw many young men who were going to platforms that had trains that were going east, that were going to Kharkiv, that were going to Kherson, that were going to the front line. And, you know, they were saying goodbye to their families. And it was clear that, you know, this was a society gripped in that trauma. And as well, I would say those we met in the collective sites who had been displaced mostly from the eastern part of the country, it didn't take very long when we began to talk to them. It's just at the surface. Their pain, their experiences, the complete upheaval in their lives, and their real desire to talk about what they have lost, people of all ages talking about what they had lost and what they hope to go back to. So as much as in some cases you can feel as though daily life has become normal in inverted commas, you don't have to look very far to really see the profound impact this has had. Even from a physical point of view, one thing I was very struck by, Frederic, was in preparation for going, in our security briefings, we were shown a map of the country from early March 2022, and it showed areas which Russia had control over, and then a map from much more recently, and you saw just how much territory Russia had been pushed back from. But on the outskirts of Kiev, where we did go to visit a commuter town, the town was called Irpin, outside of Kiev, had experienced damage on civilian infrastructure, apartment blocks, but also that very well-known bridge, the Romanivsky Bridge that had been destroyed, in fact, by the Ukrainians when the Russians were on the outskirts of Kyiv to prevent Russia from getting any closer to Kyiv. And thousands of people had to be evacuated through that bridge, through that destroyed bridge and the area around it under bombardment. It was one of those really pivotal moments in the war, and that's turned into a monument. They have decided not to reconstruct that bridge. It remains damaged there. They have built a kind of side road around it. So the, you know, terrain around the city of Kiev bears many scars, even just the parliament itself where we went. I won't go into real detail, but you see how, you know, the seat of political power has had to be adjusted to accommodate the fact that the country's at war.
Tu as évoqué tout à l'heure le rôle des organisations internationales, et notamment de l'Organisation des Nations Unies. Ça peut paraître un peu étonnant que l'ONU ou des agences comme le HCR soient présentes en Ukraine, dans la mesure où la Russie a un droit de veto au Conseil de sécurité des Nations Unies, donc on pourrait s'attendre à ce que ça paralyse l'action des organisations internationales. Qu'est-ce que fait l'ONU exactement en Ukraine?
Yes, it's a fantastic question because it's the question that Ukrainians ask as well, right? And in talking with those working with UN agencies on the ground, there are very talented staff, well-funded staff from all of the UN agencies on the ground who, of course, have consent and an invitation from the Ukrainian government to be there. UNICEF, UN Women, UNHCR, the Office of the Coordinator for Humanitarian Affairs, a representative of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, the World Food Program, all of these organizations are there working under the resident coordinator for these efforts at protection and longer-term solutions. But those officials describe the difficulty in conversations with Ukrainians in distinguishing between the UN's intergovernmental bodies and the UN's agencies. So the Ukrainian population is very frustrated by the intergovernmental bodies of the UN system, like the Security Council, which of course is deadlocked over the war, but has also been the setting for great theater and statements and debate between Western diplomats and Russian diplomats. And they talk about the UN's role being a disappointment, but of course you need to remind them that that's one part of the UN, that the UN is extremely active supporting Ukrainian society in the multiple challenges that it faces. And these UN agencies, fortunately, are well-funded, extremely well-funded so that they can do their work. I think that's one of the things that I found most impressionnant is that, you know, compared to so many other contexts, whether we think of Sudan right now or elsewhere, Ukrainians are very fortunate that aspects of the UN's work in terms of its agencies are very well financially supported and well-resourced.
Je voudrais qu'on parle quand même des conditions dans lesquelles vivent ces personnes déplacées à l'intérieur de leur pays. tu as donné déjà une idée du défi immense que ça représente. Tu en as rencontré plusieurs. Mais concrètement, une personne déplacée à l'intérieur, comment vit-elle? Elle vit dans un camp? Elle vit chez des membres de leur famille? À quoi ressemble leur existence à l'heure actuelle?
Well, it varies enormously. And of course, many Ukrainians, particularly in the west of the country, so one of our meetings was with the mayor of Lviv, who is an incredibly dynamic character, who's incredibly proud of the number of Ukrainians that have either passed through his city or who live in his city. Indeed, Lviv hosts many, many IDPs. And I'd say their, you know, living situation, their personal situation differs enormously. So as I mentioned to you, there are about 120,000 that are living in temporary accommodation collective sites, some of which are funded by Western governments. We visited one in Lviv that was funded by the UK and Polish government, really innovative, kind of modular housing. And I found it interesting that there were mostly mothers with children and those with disabilities in those sites who are living communally. These are shared kitchens. They're often shared rooms. People have a very small space of their own in which they're living. But we also visited what I would describe as an incredibly innovative collective site called Urban Camp that is in the outskirts of Lviv, that is run by a very dynamic and entrepreneurial man from Kharkiv who ran a youth center in Kharkiv and had taken over a Soviet era building, had gotten donor money to refurbish it. And it reminded me of, you know, huge lofts in New York City with kind of open beams and a very teenaged feel inside, very kind of groovy feel inside, with an enormous gymnasium, with graffiti murals, with a theater for musical and drama productions, with lots of teenagers living in it, again, communally sharing rooms, some of them going to school. So, you know, very different. And then you have IDPs who are in the private accommodation market and many, many others who are living in the homes of relatives or friends. So I would say also, Frederic, the, you know, the needs of these IDPs differ enormously. In some cases, it's the needs are really related to employment. In other cases, much more substantial social support. There are IDPs who've sustained serious injury from the war. They need psychosocial support. Their needs are enormous. So there's huge variation, I think, as there is with many situations of IDPs.
Ouais, ça fait réfléchir quand même quand on pense à l'incapacité de nos États riches et en paix à juguler la crise de l'itinérance dans les villes aujourd'hui, ce que doit représenter les volumes extrêmement importants de personnes qui doivent être logées et dont on doit s'occuper dans un pays en guerre comme l'Ukraine. Et évidemment, il y a une question qui va se poser, c'est celle du retour à la maison, pas seulement des personnes déplacées à l'intérieur du pays, mais également, tu as mentionné les chiffres, les proportions sont à peu près de 50-50, tous les réfugiés qui sont essentiellement en Europe et un peu en Amérique du Nord aujourd'hui ou dans d'autres pays. Est-ce qu'on peut imaginer un retour à la maison dans un horizon de temps raisonnable ou est-ce que c'est une situation qui est appelée à se pérenniser?
Yes, I think this is the million dollar question. Some IDPs have already returned and there have been conditions that have been safe enough for them to do so. And when you speak, as we did, to IDPs, a huge proportion want to go back. That is their firm wish. And they want to go back and reclaim their properties, which of course will be very difficult. One of the major pieces of legislation and policy initiatives is around compensation as well. And you will have seen that the General Assembly of the UN passed a resolution on compensation for war damages in Ukraine, and that the Council of Europe is setting up a registry for information on damages. So there is still an enormous amount of hope in return. But I do think your question is a very good one about whether that time horizon, which seems like it might be immediate or in the medium term, is realistic. I think there are many younger IDPs who are not necessarily living with a plan to return to their regions of origin, but rather partly because of education that they've undertaken, are unlikely to go back. And then you had some elderly IDPs, and I remember talking to one man who said, "I'm too old to restart my life again," which I found, you know, very poignant. And he just said, I can't do it. I don't have it within me to do it." So I think, you know, for them, that may not be possible. But it is, you know, one of the questions I asked myself and we asked as our group with different government ministries are, what are your strategic planning assumptions? What are the scenarios? For example, we met with the Ministry of Regional Development, which is looking at infrastructure. And of course, one can understand politically the answer they give us. They give us the answer, we work to one scenario, and that is we win the war and this ends. And our IDPs, the vast majority, go home. But, you know, our question is, can you continue to work under that assumption alone, or do you need multiple scenarios? And I think that's a hard question. It was one, I think, that the representatives of different national governments with missions in Ukraine also are asking themselves and, you know, will need to engage in conversations with the Ukrainian population about. But I would just say, as a final point, I think one of the most troubling aspects of this discussion is that the areas under current Russian occupation are a black hole. There's very little known about what is going on in those territories, other than the stories we hear from people who have fled them and the information that we get from the Human Rights Council's Commission of Inquiry, which has provided pretty graphic reporting on the violations of IHL and other violations that are occurring. And so when we think about the future, we also have to think about whether those territories will be liberated, and if so, what would return look like there, and a larger set of issues around, you know, just social integration.
Je précise pour nos auditrices et nos auditeurs francophones que IHL, c'est le droit international humanitaire en français. Tu as évoqué il y a quelques instants les rencontres que vous avez eues avec les fonctionnaires. Et justement, j'avais envie de te poser une question sur l'État ukrainien. Donc, on a une image un peu contrastée. D'un côté, un État qui avait la réputation d'être plutôt dysfonctionnel, assez corrompu, un pays qui est quand même, à l'échelle européenne, encore aujourd'hui très pauvre et qui, aujourd'hui, en plus, est appauvri davantage par cette guerre. Et en même temps, il y a cet espoir que l'État ukrainien puisse rapidement se reconstruire, malgré un contexte qui semble plutôt s'enliser, donc se reconstruire dans un état de guerre peut-être permanent. Et certains disent même que, rapidement, l'Ukraine devrait adhérer à l'Union européenne, voire à l'OTAN. Et c'est d'ailleurs la demande principale des élus, des représentants politiques ukrainiens. Est-ce que ça te paraît crédible, à la fois une reconstruction de l'État ukrainien autour d'un modèle, disons, fonctionnel, et puis un État ukrainien qui soit prêt à se joindre à l'Union européenne?
Yes, many things to say here, Frederick. I guess I'd begin answering your points by saying, we were incredibly struck by the dedication, capacity, innovation of Ukrainian government officials. So much has been done, particularly when we compare it to other contexts of IDPs in terms of the legislative agenda, in terms of scoping out the kinds of policy frameworks that need to be designed. The questions are difficult, but many of them they are not avoiding. On the other hand, they face an enormous human capital challenge. So much talent has left the country. When we spoke to the Minister of Social Policy, who had a very progressive and far-sighted sense of the kinds of policies that needed to be in place, we also heard her describe a close to 50% vacancy rate inside her ministry. And so the capacity to implement many of the tasks that are required is really being stretched. But I think joining the EU is credible. As you know, I am an optimist. So, you know, that it partly reflects my optimism. But already Ukraine is, and Ukrainian officials are beginning to respond to some of the reform imperatives associated with that. So I'll give you one example, and that is decentralization of governance. This is something that the EU is encouraging and that Ukrainians are beginning to embrace. It's very difficult for them to devolve governance to the Oblast region, to understand what decentralized governance really entails, given their experience with a much more centralized system. But the work is underway, and there are some regions doing this, you know, fairly well already. But you're absolutely right that there is going to be a situation going forward of part war, part reconstruction. The European Union has already thrown down the gauntlet with what I understand to be a $50 billion fund for reconstruction. And I think if that fund is accompanied by a detailed plan of priorities and a recognition of the need to accompany it with a program of supplementing the human resources needed to do it, I think it's not impossible to imagine Ukraine joining the European Union.
Un aspect qui pourrait rendre les choses plus difficiles, c'est la question de la mobilisation internationale, et je voudrais en parler dans un instant, mais d'abord, je voudrais te poser une question sur une dimension qui m'inquiète en théorie, même si à l'heure actuelle, je ne vois pas d'éléments empiriques qui justifient ma crainte. Mais j'aimerais quand même savoir ce que tu as pu voir sur le terrain, parce que tu as rencontré beaucoup de membres de la société civile. Et c'est vrai que depuis le 24 février 2022, on a beaucoup insisté sur la force de la société civile ukrainienne. Ça semble impressionnant, mais en théorie, ce qu'on sait des conflits, des guerres, c'est qu'il est très difficile de maintenir les libertés publiques, la cohésion sociale dans un contexte de guerre prolongée. Et ça, évidemment, si par exemple on observait d'ici 5 ans une détérioration de l'état de droit ou des libertés fondamentales en Ukraine, ça remettrait sérieusement en question, par exemple, la perspective d'adhésion à l'Union européenne. À quoi ressemble la situation sur le terrain? Est-ce que mes craintes théoriques sont fondées ou est-ce qu'il y a là aussi raison de rester optimiste à la Jennifer?
There are aspects of this question that I think there are grounds to have some concerns. But let me begin with the good news. You know, one of the main purposes of our trip was to really investigate the participation of displaced persons in the governance of their situation, right? So one of the things that we did as part of the trip was attend a 2-day national forum of IDP councils in Kyiv that brought together representatives of civil society, of IDP councils from across the country. And the creation of these self-governance mechanisms where IDPs themselves were represented in helping local authorities devise policy solutions, helping inform the legislative agenda, participating very, very actively. And as part of this, also, of course, asking questions about how they could continue to participate electorally. We also met with about 20 organizations, women's-led organizations, civil society organizations in Ukraine, who were working very actively on the ground with their constituencies. And so what I saw from the time I was there, and of course it's a partial perspective, is a very vibrant civil society that is sustaining its activity even in a very, very difficult situation and making sure that the political system continues to, you know, realize the rights of those who are being affected by the war. I think the more difficult issue is around questions in the East around the rights of those in occupied territories, perhaps in the future, or those areas that have been liberated, and the, you know, passage of a collaborators law in Ukraine, which wants to call out those instances where there have been examples of collaboration with the Russian occupiers. And there, I think there needs to be enormous care taken that this does not cast a very deep, deep shadow over those parts of Ukraine, because we do need to think forward to, if one is an optimist, to the day in which those populations need to once again live together. So that's one piece that I left asking myself questions about. You know, how will this issue be treated as we move forward? But I do think there's lots of evidence that civil society is surviving and that the rights of Ukrainian citizens, even in this very difficult situation, are being respected.
Si tu le permets, j'aimerais te poser une dernière question qui porte davantage sur les relations internationales et sur la façon dont elles sont perçues en Ukraine. J'ai l'impression que l'Occident n'a pas réussi à convaincre le reste du monde que l'invasion russe était un enjeu existentiel. Et si on regarde ce qui se passe à Washington, les États-Unis, les républicains, pardon, aux États-Unis menacent de couper une aide qui est vitale pour l'effort militaire, mais aussi la reconstruction de l'Ukraine. Pendant que tu étais en Ukraine, j'ai eu le privilège d'interroger notre ministre des Affaires étrangères, Mélanie Joly, et je lui ai demandé ce que le Canada pouvait faire pour accroître son soutien à l'Ukraine dans un contexte où l'attention se porte désormais davantage sur le conflit en Palestine et donc il y aurait quelque chose comme une fatigue déjà du conflit ukrainien. J'imagine que les Ukrainiens et les Ukrainiennes que tu as rencontrés doivent se poser la même question, doivent avoir la même inquiétude, non?
Absolutely. One of the most striking images I left with was the image of the TV screens in Ukrainian bars and restaurants. Many of them are often showing on one screen images of the war, of soldiers, of the front line, of civilians, of different things associated with the war effort. And the screen right next to it is showing US Congress or US politics and following it very, very closely. So, of course, this is a deep concern. And in fact, at Urban Camp, during our visit with a group of teenagers, a young man, Valeri, asked us exactly this. He said, you know, I have a question for all of you. There's another war going on. What will this mean for us? Are you going to forget about us? And it was difficult to answer in a way that would be comforting. And I think that, you know, the key challenge for advanced Western democracies right now is that many of the contexts we face are protracted situations. It's not as if, you know, we're going to have a crisis and then a couple of years and another crisis. As we've talked about on this podcast so often, we're in an era of sustained crisis. And that requires sustained attention. And this is incredibly difficult. But I do think it's important, and I left with this impression as well, to remember that the support that Ukraine needs, yes, it needs military support. And that needs to be ongoing and significant to ensure it can sustain its effort. But there is also a lot of direct budget support required, support for reconstruction. But, you know, Ukraine has a massive hole in its basic budget to fund governance services because it is allocating so much to the war effort. And so those who cannot provide direct military assistance have a job to do in the other forms of assistance that Ukraine requires. And that set of resources also will have a really dramatic impact, positive impact, I think.
Ouais, là, ce qui est pas très réjouissant, c'est que, évidemment, ce soutien budgétaire jusqu'à maintenant ou dans les mois récents est surtout venu de l'Union européenne et on voit dans la politique européenne aussi des phénomènes semblables à Washington où dans un certain nombre de pays, les partis de droite notamment, s'opposent de plus en plus à l'aide européenne à l'Ukraine. Mais ça, ce serait un autre sujet. Jennifer, merci infiniment d'avoir partagé ton témoignage vraiment unique avec moi et avec les auditrices et les auditeurs de Tour de table. On devrait faire ça plus souvent, tête-à-tête, après une enquête à l'extérieur ou sur des sujets qui nous intéressent.
Une excellente idée.
Donc, merci.
To learn more about McGill University's Center for International Peace and Security Studies, please visit us at sepsi.sips.ca. Follow us on Twitter/X at @sips_McGill. Subscribe for more episodes of Tour de Table, available on our website, sepsi-sips.ca.
Et également sur Spotify et bien d'autres endroits où vous pouvez télécharger vos balados préférés. Et pour en apprendre davantage sur l'Université de Montréal, le département de sciences politiques ou le Centre d'études et de recherche internationale, le CERIUM, vous pouvez me suivre sur X, toujours, où j'aime pour l'instant toujours partager les activités et les analyses de mes collègues.
That's it from us. Thank you to Karim Faraj, our producer. We hope you enjoyed listening.